The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to the Lawfare Podcast. I'm Benjamin Wittes. Today on the podcast, the second installment in a series of presentations made at the Hoover Institution on October 25th to a group of distinguished journalists Hoover gathered for a media colloquium with its task force on national security and law. This presentation was given by two people who need no introduction to Lawfare readers, Matt Waxman, who speaks first, and Kenneth Anderson, who speaks second. It deals with autonomous weapons and the calls on the part of human rights groups for a preemptive international law ban on autonomous lethal firing power. The discussion is, once again, edited both for length and because not all of the journalists present consented to have their portions of the audio used.
Great. Well, thanks very much. So this is not a talk about armed drones or UAVs per se, but it does look back on the last 10 years history of drones in order to draw some general lessons for U.S. policy and then apply them to some future weapon technologies that Ken and I have been studying. And before talking about those future technologies, let me begin by emphasizing three general points. The first is that historically it's often been the case that that new weapon technologies give rise to fears that their emergence, their deployment on the battlefield will destroy the existing legal and ethical constraints on warfare. It'll tear down the existing ethical edifice that governs battlefield activity, and this raises questions whether they should just be banned outright. This has been the story with some technologies going back centuries, the crossbow, the submarine, the bomber airplane, and so on. Rarely do proposed bans of these new weapons work, especially if at least one side sees them as very effective. And often, I think, in retrospect, these worries about new technologies undermining the law and ethics of warfare turn out to be, prove in hindsight, to be overblown. The second point is that the United States has a strategic interest in demonstrating to the world that the existing body of the laws of war, or international humanitarian law, can be adapted to effectively govern new weapon technologies coming online, and also a strategic interest in setting through its own actions, the United States' own actions, a very high standard for complying with those laws. I think there are obvious legal and moral reasons for this, but we think that this is in the U.S. strategic interest too. It's in our interest to strengthen the laws of war and to demonstrate that the laws of war are a robust system capable of striking reasonable balance between security and humanitarian concerns into the future. And I think these objectives also are important to sustaining domestic and political support for our military actions, to raising costs to our adversaries or rivals who might try to gain an advantage by violating those laws and so forth. The third general point to begin with is that the last 10 years history with regard to drones demonstrates, I think, very clearly that this set of goals that I just articulated, demonstrating to the world that the existing body of the laws of war can be adapted to effectively govern new weapon technologies and setting through its actions the United States a gold standard for complying with those laws, those goals are in some tension with operational and bureaucratic tendencies towards secrecy. I think it's hard to get this balance right and to get the right, to calibrate the right balance between a desire to prove the utility and compliance with the laws of war and the desire to maintain operational secrecy, in part because even if you buy into our proposition that shaping international law is a core strategic interest of the United States, when it comes to day-to-day operational decisions, those goals always, it's always easy to see those goals as distant and diffuse, whereas the imperatives of secrecy seem much more immediate and tangible. And so while I applaud President Obama, for example, for a number of the speeches he's given, the kind of presidential and cabinet-level speeches that we talked about in the last session are helpful, but they don't get this done. The Obama administration is not nearly as transparent on these matters as it thinks it is. My own experience working inside the government, including on presidential speeches regarding counterterrorism policies, for example, is that you always think on the inside that you're being a lot more transparent than you really are. I think the kind of agenda that Ken and I are talking about requires a much more sustained effort and requires getting into a level of detail about operational practices that the U.S. government, including the Obama administration, has been very reluctant to do. So, for example, I think the United States could be doing a much better job of communicating about exactly how it avoids collateral damage, how it assesses collateral damage after strikes, and so forth. And as a result, the United States has largely lost control of the public and international debate about drones. I think the latest reports from human rights groups this week help to show that. So, with those three general points about technology and U.S. interests in the laws of war, let me pivot and look to the future a bit and talk about some technologies, in particular autonomous weapon systems, that Ken and I are interested in, because I think those lessons of the past can really help guide us in thinking about a policy for the future. So what if armed drones that we've been talking about already today were not just piloted remotely by humans in faraway bunkers in a desert, but they were programmed under certain circumstances to select and fire at some targets entirely on their own? This may sound like science fiction, and deployment of such systems is indeed far off. But as Ken is going to talk a little bit more about in his remarks, policy decisions, legal debates, research and development decisions are already taking place now and in ways that could radically affect the future development of these kinds of systems. In addition, many human rights NGOs joined last week by a new international coalition of computing scientists have been calling for a policy of preemptively banning the development of and use of autonomous weapon systems. We think the United States should resist that prohibition. That's one of the main points we want to make today. The United States policy should be to resist that call for a ban or prohibition, and not just out of concerns for military efficacy, but for some important moral reasons as well. But to do so, to effectively resist those calls for a ban, it's important that the United States present a viable alternative. And doing so, in particular, I think requires showing that the laws of war, as I said before, can be effectively adapted in order to regulate these technologies effectively. So at this point, no country has yet at least publicly evinced plans to use fully autonomous weapon systems specifically to target humans. Some countries, including the United States, though, already use autonomous or nearly autonomous systems for targeting other machines. Examples include anti-missile defense systems aboard Navy ships, for example, that will autonomously, once flipped on and perhaps with some degree of human oversight, will target incoming missiles. And this technology is useful because in order to defend against large numbers of incoming missiles, requires decision making beyond the capacity for human decision making. We expect, though, there to be broader application of autonomous weapons, including possibly against human targets, emerging incrementally in the future. I say incrementally, and I want to emphasize that point, because rather than a sudden shift from human control to machine control when it comes to weapon systems, I think in many contexts, we're more likely to see greater and greater automation being added gradually, perhaps more aspects of firing decisions being automated, the human role gradually shifting from being in full control to a role of oversight or perhaps overriding potential decisions by a machine. And we see this evolution towards autonomous machine decision making on the battlefield as inevitable for a couple of reasons. Some of it driven by technology as machine sensors, analytics, machine learning improve, as states demand greater protection for their own military personnel as well as for civilians, as new weapon other weapon technologies, perhaps what are sometimes called less than lethal technologies, come online, and also as similar automation technologies show up in other areas of society and prove to be better than human decision makers, even when there are lethal consequences at stake. Driverless cars, robotic surgery, and so forth. And I think we're going to accept more and more machine automated and autonomous decision making, not just because we think that it's more efficient, it eases burdens on humans, but because we find that they do a better job than in certain tasks than human decision makers. So bringing us back to weapons, proponents of banning autonomous weapons, usually by proposing some sort of global treaty, usually argue, among other things, that these systems risk dehumanizing warfare, thereby eroding ethical constraints on it. And they also tend to argue that artificial intelligence is never going to be capable of meeting the requirements of the laws of war. For example, the requirement of discriminating between legitimate military targets and civilian targets, that there will machines will never be capable of accurately and legally making judgments about proportionality and avoiding excessive collateral damage. As a moral matter, I think many critics, proponents of banning autonomous weapon systems, also don't believe that as a moral matter, decisions to intentionally kill should ever be delegated to machines. And they also believe that as a practical matter, there are just too many uncertainties. Machines are going to operate in unpredictable ways or be used perhaps in irresponsible, even ruthless ways. For us, I think part of our argument is that a treaty ban is unlikely to work, though, especially in constraining those states whose behavior we're most concerned about. But we also believe that because automation moving towards full autonomy of weapons will increase gradually, step by step, it's not nearly as easy to design and enforce the kind of treaty prohibition that NGOs are calling for as I think they believe. In any event, though, even if it were possible, I think if the goal of a ban If the goal of regulating autonomous weapon systems is to reduce suffering, to protect human lives, then we think a ban may be counterproductive and even dangerous. Besides the self-protective advantages of to military forces that might use autonomous weapon systems, it's quite possible that autonomous machine decision-making may, at least in some contexts, reduce risks to civilians by making targeting decisions more precise, by making targeting decisions more controlled. It's true that I think advocates of artificial intelligence have at times in past decades overpromised before. There's this allure of technology, and somehow artificial intelligence never quite seems to live up to its initial promise. And I think we should be careful about putting our faith in these kinds of technologies. At the same time, though, we also know for certain that humans are limited in their capacity to make sound and ethical decisions on the battlefield. And that's partly a result of just inherent limits of human brain capacity, but it's also the result of things like sensory error, fear, anger, fatigue, and other features that machine decision-making may in some contexts be able to compensate for. We also believe that as a moral matter, states should be striving to use the most sparing methods or means of warfare. And at some point, that may include autonomous machine decision making. Now, nobody can say with certainty how much automation technologies might gradually reduce the harms of warfare. Our argument, though, is that it would be morally wrong not to seek such gains if they can be had. The idea of sort of cutting off research and development into these systems before we even know how effective they can be or not. Now, to be very, very clear, our argument here is not that autonomous weapon systems warrant no special regulation or that the United States should heedlessly rush to develop them. I think that's been one of the perceptions of U.S. use of drones, is that we deploy and shoot first and then ask questions about ethics and law later. What Ken and I have argued at length in a policy paper is that a much better solution than a global ban is to adapt the existing laws of war to deal with autonomous systems. How would we do that? First, the United States should set very high standards internally for assessing legally and ethically any research and development programs in this area, and for continually assessing legally and ethically any use of such systems. And importantly, and here's, I think, one of the critical lessons drawn from our experience with drones, the United States needs to be prepared to discuss publicly as much as possible about exactly how it conducts those reviews, according to what metrics, and so forth. Second, I think to make this policy work, the United States can't go it alone. It should work with a coalition of like-minded partners to try to set some standards and develop best practices in this area. Some allies have already shown an interest, a like-mindedness on these issues. Recently, the British government, for example, responded to NGO calls for a ban by instead declaring its view that the existing international law of war, law of armed conflict, already provides a strong framework that if the British were to develop these kinds of systems, could provide a robust set of rules and standards, and also suggesting that the British government is interested in engaging in a cooperative development of standards to govern these kinds of systems. So. I'll close and turn it over to Ken by saying I think our if I were to sum up in a sentence our view, it's that autonomous weapon systems are not inherently unethical or unlawful, and provided that we start now, they can be made to serve the ends of law, the laws of war on the battlefield.
Thank you. I'm going to actually be much shorter and really just insert some comments that go inside the structure that Matt has already laid out. And really, they're sort of detailed comments that fit within that outline. So the first of these is to emphasize this incremental point. to emphasize that, for example, drones that are a remotely piloted vehicle today are gradually becoming more automated as the technology advances. And this is most visible in the flying around parts of the machine, namely the ability to sort of land and take off and do this sort of stuff. And that will gradually be an accumulation of technologies that automates the platform until the point of which the sum becomes greater, the whole becomes greater than the sum of the parts, and enables something that could be automated to be able to do it completely by itself. Not necessarily autonomous, if by autonomous one means at that stage the ability to select where it decides to go, but to be able to execute a flight path, get itself off the ground, go land someplace. But that does not actually tell us anything about weapons. The decision to decide to automate the weapon system, where DoD's definition of an autonomous weapon system is, I think, pretty widely accepted. And it says that it's a system, if it's fully autonomous, that is able to select its own targets and engage them on its own once the switch is flipped. And that decision is one that is very different from deciding that it would be safer and better for the technology if it were able to land itself. And that decision about whether to make that weapon firing selection of targets autonomous is something that involves, certainly within DoD's understanding of its obligations under the laws of war, a very, very major step. And one of the things that I think is puzzling to, or certainly was a surprise to the Department of Defense, and at least in my conversations with lawyers there, was that they were quite taken by surprise by the idea that a ban campaign would emerge looking to prohibit autonomous weapons, because they had a completely different sense about what threats they were looking to counter. So if the threats are, as Matt has described, that you have a gazillion little tiny missiles coming independently at you from a zillion different angles, unless you find a way to counter all of those missiles, the ship is very likely going to sink. And those are events are taking place at faster than human reaction speeds, and we've had a policy in place of building counter-missile systems that are very highly automated that run all the way back to the 1980s. And that doesn't seem to actually present a great problem. You're addressing machine-on-machine threats. There may well be human beings who are inside those machines. Those human beings will, by and large, be lawful targets in war in any case, but you're targeting the machine. And that has not been understood to really present a problem. So it I think, was actually something of a surprise to people at DoD to see a campaign for banning these things that was based around a very futuristic, frankly sci-fi and somewhat cartoonish idea that the U.S.'s development efforts were designed to produce kind of marching automated robot soldiers going onto the battlefield to hunt down enemies and kill them. And to do so in the most difficult conceivable environment of hidden fighters among a civilian population in a crowded urban area, this is kind of beyond what anybody that I was aware of has ever been thinking. It leads me to a second point, which is DARPA is not the Department of Defense. When DARPA comes up as an independent thing with its own sort of VC people and folks like that on its board and puts out these sort of proposals for contests and the rest, this is a very, very, very long way from what actually the procurement process, the weapons design process, the legal review process that takes place at DoD. And that process at DoD, we have been encouraging them, and I think that they've actually already long taken on board, says that, in effect, the review process for weapons development needs to involve lawyers from the very moment that you get a glimmer in the eye of a designer. And the reason this needs to happen is because it may be that that weapon can never, and you can tell from the outset, is never going to wind up satisfying the requirements of the laws of war, at least for any battlefield use for which you think you're designing it. So things that take place between ships at sea will be really different in terms of the lawfulness of their legal uses from that that takes place in a crowded urban setting, and the same technology that's legal in one may not be legal in another. And the lawyers need to be part of that review from the beginning in order to help guide the design path, or else to put the brakes on it before it happens. DoD lawyers do this all the time, particularly in the cyber area, and that, you know, people come up with all sorts of crazy proposals, and the lawyers shoot them down from a fairly, you know, early stage. But it's important to understand that what comes out of the kind of things that are kind of attached to but not actually part of the official process need to be considered very separately. The third point, I guess, that I'd like to make is to go to the ban campaign, which the ban, as Human Rights Watch has proposed it, calls for something that duplicates, in effect, the landmines ban campaign from the early 1990s. And I feel personally in a somewhat awkward situation because I was the first director of the Human Rights Watch arms division that is doing this at Human Rights Watch. And I can't tell you how proud I am of the work that I did in trying to get anti-personnel landmines banned at that point, and am to this day. But I don't think that these non-existent, evolving future weapons are remotely like a landmine. Landmines, we know what the technology is, we know what the capabilities are, we know why it's an indiscriminate weapon, and there are no trade-offs except for maybe some amount of force protection when you do it. And this could not be at a greater contrast to the kinds of technologies that we don't know where things are going to go. We don't know what the trade-offs are going to be in terms of the ability to more precisely target, the ability to reduce the harms on the battlefield. And we just don't know what those trade-offs are. And the second part of Human Rights Watch's call for a ban, which has been embraced by a number of the NGOs, has a vague but really, I think, quite disturbing call for a ban on development of technologies. And then the language gets vague. It doesn't say ban the technologies that could lead to, but it says they have to be reviewed. And there the review seems to be pointing at something that, and again, the language is vague and I recommend looking at it, but it says they have to be reviewed for the possibility that they might lead, that technologies or components of technologies that might lead to an autonomous lethal weapon need to be reviewed from the earliest stages, and it's not clear reviewed for what. But I think the question that arises here is, why one would want to ban things in research and development where there could be enormous gains for battlefield reduction of harm to everybody involved? Why would one want to do that? My guess actually is that it's because it's been modeled on the idea that these robot weapons should be understood in the way that bioweapons are understood. And you need to get a hold of the graduate student in the bioweapon area who's got his or her hands on a, you know, genetic machinery and has the blueprint for smallpox. And the moment that that grad student even starts to get close to, you know, anything remotely like that, and you need to put the kibosh on that and kind of end it up front. And that's because it's self-replicating. But the robots we're talking about are not self-replicating. We're talking about technological paths where there can be enormous beneficial effects in terms of controlling harm on the battlefield. It may be that we never get to the point that any of these things, insofar as they're involved in either directly targeting humans or targeting humans in civilian environments, we maybe never get even close to the ability to actually flip on the weapon and tell it to go do its thing. But we also don't know how close we will get to that, and in leaving humans still in the loop to be able to help monitor and be on the loop or in the loop for those processes, we actually achieve a sort of combination that turns out to be fantastically more precise and fantastically safer. Now, the Two other things that I guess I'd say would be this form of ban cannot work because the technologies that are going to be at issue for making a weapon system genuinely autonomous are going to be pretty much identical to the technologies that will be spread throughout the civilian area. Self-driving cars, the robotic surgery, I mean, just the list goes on and on. And it's, I think, if it turns out that those technologies play out as people are hoping they will, and I haven't the faintest idea, I don't know how far they'll get. But if it turns out that those automation technologies turn out to be vastly more effective in the self-driving car area, for example, it's, I think, pretty difficult to imagine that a future generation that has grown up with the cars driving themselves around and we see visible increases in safety and people understand and accept that, it's impossible for me to imagine that they're not going to both be comfortable with but also demand on practical but also moral grounds that these technologies at least be made available to see whether they can be adapted to make war a less harmful thing as well. And so the question of the spread of these things into civilian technologies also raises an enormous moral question. Should you be cutting off the development of these things before you know what it is they can offer in an environment in which these things are going to be widely adapted for civilian uses in many ways? Weapons can be thought of as different, and I do think of them as different in the sense that the decision to affirmatively direct, aim, and kill somebody does seem to me to be different morally from the decision that one commits over to an elder care robot to have to decide when to call 911. One of these involves an intention to actually intentionally kill somebody. The other one is really an attempt to save somebody's life and has to make decisions about what the thresholds for acting are. From the standpoint of programming the actual machine itself, it's not really clear that those aren't essentially the same kind of decision-making behaviors. And the reason is that robots don't have intention. They've got behaviors, and those behaviors are programmed. So I think I would wind up saying that there's actually a moral obligation to both shape the regulation of all of this stuff in ways that is going to wind up being protective of people on the battlefield, and also to enable us to use these kind of technologies more broadly in society, and that to fail to go down that path from a fear that it turns into a kind of killer robot scenario is, I think, actually quite mistaken. And the last point, then, is a plea to myself as well as everybody else. When Matt and I first wrote on this subject, we entitled the paper something that referred to robot soldiers. We are as in love with sci-fi in this area as everybody else is. We cannot resist the impulse to frame this all in terms of the Terminator. We, like everybody else in this, I went to deliver a speech to people telling them not to refer to sci-fi and immediately raised Asimov's three laws. I could not control myself. And I think that many of us are in that situation, but I like to suggest that at this stage, those of us who write in this area need to sort of take a step back and ask ourselves whether the reach to sci-fi future technologies and to sort of works of the imagination in this area brings with it such a sort of structure of the ways we automatically, we automatically fall into a Philip K. Dick novel, right? Every time we sort of go down this path, but that's not where the technologies are. They're at really boring places about automating this little bit and that little bit. And the real task of the lawyers is to try and see whether that in that context is going to be within the law. And it's just nowhere near as imaginatively exciting. But it is, I think, how one winds up achieving over the longer term the effective regulation of these devices without attempting to smother the technology from the beginning. So I guess my last plea is, no more sci-fi.
Spencer's going to start us off.
Yeah, a couple different questions. First on area of focus, I'm surprised you guys didn't discuss any of the actual hardware that you do see sort of encroaching into this. This discussion sort of at least implicitly categorized drone technology and autonomy within one framework. But you're seeing, at least in terms of the actual weapon system, the greater autonomy advancement is in missile technology. And to some degree, in the transformation of particularly small UAVs into something that's more like a missile than it is an airframe. Secondly, when it comes to the civilian casualty question, to some degree, and increasingly in this context, the limitation in terms of casualty is an effect of the size of the ordnance. You know, when you've the drone is an airframe, is rarely a particularly sophisticated airframe. They're often just very bad aircraft. They can't carry that much. And, you know, when you talk to weapons developers in this field, the big challenge is increasingly miniaturization rather than making the ordnance itself more of a precise thing. It's just small enough that it's not able to kill very many people outside of a, you know, the context of destroying a structure where a lot of people might be in there. And then finally, when we're really discussing, you know, the gradual advance of automation as it immediately applies to either a battlefield weapon or a weapon, or a platform at least, with real concerns about its impact on ethics, on law, and on how we conduct military operations, why are we not discussing where this really is a very advanced field, which is in the increasing and very rapid and very sophisticated automation of the surveillance side of drone technology?
Yeah, actually, I don't think I disagree with any of that, actually.
You shouldn't. It was brilliant.
I would be the last to deny it, Spencer. And the reason, actually, speaking for both of us, I guess, the reason that we've actually not emphasized the hardware in this presentation, or even in what it is that we write about this, is we think that the writing often tends to focus on the hardware without really paying attention to the granular level of regulation and legal review that is the part that would actually constrain it in any meaningful way. And we think that that is simply much less well known. It's also, and I wouldn't leave the sort of our plea to the Department of Defense for transparency. When we launched into this, we wrote an initial paper before the ban call came out that was essentially directed at DOD and saying, you guys have got to be a lot more transparent about this if you want to bring anybody along in this process over the long term, and still think that that's an enormously important part. So from, I guess, our standpoint, we think that what needs to be focused on in the public eye, and certainly what we bring best to the table, is the ability to sort of get people to think about what granular, gradual legal regulation looks like, what weapons review looks like, how you have to sort of consider these things, rather than thinking, you know, 50 years down the road or 100 years down the road to something that doesn't yet exist. What does it look like in terms of this now? So I don't think we disagree about that. Second, I do agree that the miniaturization and, or maybe I could put this another way, the notion of many UAVs are starting to look in a certain sense like a missile of some kind. Another way to think about this would be that we're not actually trying to improve the UAV so much as we're trying to improve the Tomahawk missile, making it smaller, making it more precise. And it's quite true that missile technologies for a long time have been, you know, it's the fire and forget concept. You hit the button and then it's going to go off and go wherever it's supposed to go. And the question of whether one builds into that some further capacity to be able to decide on the way there what target it ought to pick, that is a very big legal crossroads and one that I think the standards actually are and really should be very, very high for that. And on the increasing surveillance issue, I completely agree. I think, and we are not focused on it in part in this particular paper because the kind of the ban took us by surprise, and it's a ban about weapons and lethal use of weapons, but I completely agree about the surveillance question.
So I would just add, I mean, we were focusing here also on autonomous lethal machines. I think your question also gets at the inevitable fact that different technology streams are going to come together. So, for example, as we build more and more automated and ultimately autonomous machines, we're also going to see evolution in ordnance and what it is that the payload that's being delivered. So, for example, it's not just that we're going to see more and more automated machines capable of delivering a 500-pound bomb, but we may end up with highly autonomous machines that are able to deliver disabling weapons, for example, that need not kill.
Carol,
what are your concerns about the spread of this technology for automated lethal weapons spreading to terrorist groups and rogue nations? I mean, short of constraints on the development of these new technologies, what can the Western countries or the benevolent countries do to prevent these weapons from being obtained by people who have really bad intentions?
I'm very nervous about it, in part because it's inevitable. I think there's often, I think when it comes to weapon technologies, there's often too much emphasis placed on the idea that if the United States would keep these technologies in the box, that somehow they wouldn't spread globally. I think these automation technologies, including weaponized ones, are going to spread inevitably, in part because, as Ken says, autonomous weapons or automated weapons, the basic technology there, the sensors and integrating sensors with analytic capabilities and that sort of thing, are not that different from the commercialized versions of systems that would perform elder care or drive cars, et cetera. So I think the idea that you would keep this technology in the box if only the United States wouldn't deploy it, I think is a false path. Better, therefore, to think about, with some inevitable development and spread of technology in this area, what kinds of rules can the United States help set up and enforce? And that's what we're talking about doing through the laws of war, and especially by demonstrating in as transparent ways as possible a set of best practices that we adopt internally and ideally in cooperation with like-minded allies that basically set a standard for behavior and use of these systems. I think it's inevitable that that automated systems, ultimately autonomous systems, will be used by others. One of the things that we can do is try to set up a system of law and norms that allows us that puts us in a better position to condemn those practices and raise the cost of others using them outside of these rules.
Next new question is Bill.
Yeah, first let me say this is a great discussion. For me, you know, I've been covering defense for a long time, and I very rarely have mixed feelings about an issue. But drone strikes is clearly one. I mean, I'm with General Mattis on killing terrorists, but I would feel differently if the Chinese took out a Falun Gong house in California.
Another Hoover fellow, General Mattis.
My question goes to the proliferation of drones. They're out there. It's the genie's out of the bottle. Everybody wants one or is getting them. And what are the prospects that there will be some kind of international push for an agreement? And won't this, in effect, be used for the issue of lawfare, which is to constrain the U.S. while the others go on unrestrained?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not hopeful for when it comes to constraining through law the proliferation of armed UAV technologies. I mean, when we look back at our early, 2001, 2002. Armed drone operations, right? It was a surveillance drone that we, taped a missile to. And these are not difficult technologies for hostile actors, whether state or non-state actors, to develop on their own. It's hard to develop highly accurate ones. It's hard to develop systems that also have the intelligence infrastructure support, logistics, et cetera, that we have for waging a steady and very broad campaign. But the technology for sending over the border a bomb, a missile, I think is a very, very easy technology, and one that I am not hopeful that things like export controls or something like that would be very, very effective at restraining. I think it's too easy to I think the technology is actually a pretty easy technology. I don't know exactly what form this is going to take, but when I hear presentations about drone technology proliferation, I wish I knew more about what the counter drone technologies are that are being developed. Because I'd like to look at the lessons of history, and you know, one of the lessons of history in military technology is there's this constant race, right, between offensive and defensive capabilities, and new technologies drive a demand for counter technologies. And I think we're going to see that. I don't know in exactly what form, but I think we're going to see that in the drone context, in terms of being able to shoot them down, in terms of being able to jam them, and so forth. So I think, the bottom line is, I think the solution to the proliferation and the danger that drones pose to us and our allies will more likely be found in the form of technological counters than legal ones. That said, I think part of the enterprise that Ken and I are talking about is to develop and promote a set of rules that raises the political costs, the diplomatic costs for those who violate those rules. And then I'd finally just add another sort of a technology point. This goes back to Spencer's earlier comment. In my mind, what scares me more than just the proliferation, the sort of horizontal proliferation of drones, what scares me more than that is the miniaturization of them. The fact that they will become more and more difficult to detect, I think, is scarier than just the sheer proliferation of unmanned aerial machines that can carry a destructive payload.
And so in that regard, I think that we actually need to be going after Spencer, your former boss, Chris Anderson, and do-it-yourself drones, because, of course, this is...
How can I enlist? Let me know.
Chris Anderson left Wired magazine as the editor and created a company that specializes in hobbyist drones at the small level, but this is, in fact, advancing by leaps and bounds the miniaturization questions that Spencer rightly raises. The other thing I would add to this is a slightly different point about the proliferation, but it goes to the point about China decides to hit some target. And this is often framed as a kind of admonition to the United States. You're going to regret, you reap what you sow. You're going to regret having permitted all of this. And I think that that's actually quite unfair to the U.S. government in this regard. It may be that if others were acquiring these systems, it would want to tighten up the rules for everybody. But the U.S. does not actually see its use of drones, targeted killing, and these things as special pleading on the part of, say, the superpower or whatever that is. It does, in fact, see these things as being neutral rules that it sees as being applicable by other states if they were facing similar circumstances. Now, if it faced a lot of other adversaries who were also acquiring these things, it might well push for tighter rules on those, and we would encourage that in a lot of ways. But I think that it is actually unfair to regard this as simply special pleading by the powerful actor that has them at this moment. And proliferation runs both ways. We have a deep interest as the United States in seeing that our NATO allies acquire far more drones of far higher capability. And the resistance to that in Europe led when the French went into Mali. They had four drones, one of which was inoperative, and the newly installed socialist foreign defense minister said in a speech, incomprehensible that an aeronautical, I'm quoting one of New York, is that your article that I'm quoting?
But
said it's incomprehensible that an aeronautical industrial power like France should not have these weapons and should not be able to use them because they are more precise. And this was the lesson of Libya when New York Times reporters come up with this list of civilian casualties, none of which I could tell from sort of the initial description of circumstances raised a sort of law of war problem. But in looking at that, I thought it's very hard for me to believe that had they the targeting not been done with drones, that list would have been a lot shorter. And so we actually need the proliferation of these technologies insofar as we actually believe that they are more precise and are capable of reducing the harm if a party is actually interested in doing that.
And a follow-up on the lawfare part, there's a debate here on drones. Do you anticipate the UN or some international organization using lawfare to try to constrain U.S. drone development?
What do you think? I mean, I think we're already seeing, the term lawfare is thrown around a lot. It means different things to many different people. I do think your question, though, gets at an important point that we were raising earlier, which is this idea that if the United States cannot convincingly show that the law of war adequately can sort of handle these new technologies and that we are applying it in a consistent and reasonable way. And this also goes to Jack's point. And this is, whether it's CIA, JSOC, whoever, if we can't show that on a consistent basis, we are employing these rules, following them, and that they're striking good balances, I think the movement to come in and replace the laws of war or overlay them with some other set of rules will grow. That's why I think the United States has a strategic interest in showing this is actually a good set of rules that strikes good balances, that meets the demands and challenges that new technologies are presenting.
Do you have something to add, at least? Or?
Well, I was just wondering if you could expand on what you started in the earlier part of the discussion about, like, the more scarier aspects of autonomous selection of targets. And at that point, when you have the proliferation of these type of technologies and we're using them and they're using them, and I think it almost kind of dehumanizes the whole idea of war and makes it more, more of an easier choice. Mm-hmm. And probably there's proliferation of war in that sense when the cost to us and to the it just it seems pointless in one sense to if there's no cost to either side except mm-hmm. financial if you're developing these technologies. That's when I think the proliferation of war and the desensitization of it is the scarier.
Well, I think I'd respond to that in a couple ways, and I'm sure Ken will have some thoughts on it too. The first one is to reiterate my point earlier that's a common argument, but it's one that comes up with new technologies all the time, and in some ways we've already sort of crossed that that threshold long ago. I mean, the idea of fighting, waging conflict from a distance where basically our forces are, for the most part, out of harm's way, but we can reach the other guy's forces. That's a feature of air power. That's a feature of cruise missiles. This was an argument about the crossbow and the concern that, honorable warfare was fought face to face. There is no obligation in, I think, ethically or legally to put yourself in harm's way when waging a war. I think the idea of finding technological ways that enable you to hit the other guy without being hit. Not only do I think that's a legal and ethical way to wage war, but it's one that we ought to be supporting. Now, there's a concern, though, I think, that you're getting at, that if you lower the cost the cost too much of using force, that we then kind of overuse it. And that's, I have a few responses to that. I mean, the first point is, I'm not sure that that casualties are currently what's holding us back from using force in faraway regions, because we can do so with piloted, remotely piloted drones. Taking the pilot out of it, I don't know, changes the cost to us in a significant way. But I'm also, I think if we want to get the right policy balance right, of when is the use of force appropriate, right? When should the United States intervene to deal with humanitarian crisis? When should the United States or other states use military force in order to deal with threats? I think trying to kind of micromanage the development of technology as a way of getting at that broader policy problem is very unlikely to strike the right balance. And indeed, while it's possible that new technologies would enable low-cost interventions in some circumstances that we think would be terrible, they may also enable us to intervene in low-cost ways, in ways that would do great good. We may be able to deal with humanitarian emergencies through automated technologies that we wouldn't otherwise be able to deal with effectively, for example.
And I guess the only follow-up I'd make to that would be that this is part of a sort of general argument about that these technologies make the resort to force too easy. And I think that the problem with that argument is, first of all, that easier is not the same as too easy. And knowing that it's in fact easier, which in fact these technologies do, is not actually an answer to the question of whether it's too easy. Because I think the answer to too easy depends on whether the use of force that you're contemplating doing is lawful, whether it's ethical, whether it would meet the requirements of just war and these various things. And so the answer to too easy is not a sort of an economist balancing game, a sort of efficient equilibrium. It's a moral question of whether the use of force that you're contemplating is justified. And if it is justified, then you are justified in doing it in a way that protects your people, because you are doing it in some fashion because you reasonably believe that you are acting in self-defense, and it's not an obligation to sacrifice yourself in the process of defending yourself. You have to do that consistent with what the protection of civilians is all about. But the idea, I'm increasingly surprised at some of the arguments that are made toward the banning of killer robots and the rest that say honorable human beings fight Homo sapien against Homo sapien, and think, no, actually they don't. A side that reasonably believes that it is the just side is not required to go into sort of combat on equal terms with the other side in this. It's required to do so in a way that protects the civilians. And we also admit that each side is able to make its own judgment about whether its side is just, because we're not able to sort of settle that. We're not God. But we do wind up saying that you aren't required to sacrifice yourself and put yourself into an arena to fight on the same terms as the other person. So I think that it's actually quite a troubling moral argument that we somehow have an obligation to expose our soldiers to risk in order to put their own political leadership under pressure not to overuse force. That's holding them as hostages, right? That's holding our own military people as hostages against the behavior of their political leaders, and I don't think you can run those two together. The decision about whether it's right, proper, just, legal to use force has to be kept separate from the question of whether you, once you're committed to doing that, do so in the least harmful way, including protection of civilians and protection of soldiers.
I just wanted to ask about one of the objections you mentioned in your writing, which I thought was intriguing, which is that, well, if there were a war crime, we wouldn't know who to hold responsible. And I just wonder how you think about that.
So this raises the question of accountability and liability as well. And I guess I'd say that I'm very sympathetic to this argument, because I think that one of the enormous protections that arises out of the laws of war is the notion that one holds people liable. And as is true in tort systems and product liability systems and the rest, there are forms of liability, but they're going to be really different because it somehow doesn't really seem quite right to hold the programmer responsible for a war crime in which the system could not reasonably have been said to have anticipated the kind of situation it was put in. And so the question of whether the human being disappears from the loop, so to speak, and all this from a liability standpoint, I think, is a very live question. That said, I think the question of automation and autonomy and machine decision making that does take the mechanisms that we use to hold people who are conscious, intentional, conscience-bearing actors accountable, but which don't apply to a machine, I hesitate to remove those until I see a pattern of the machine simply being able to do it in brute fact better than the human beings. And accountability is not actually an end in itself. Accountability in the war setting is a mechanism by which war crimes, liability, locking people up, all of these things are mechanisms by which we attempt to get actors in the battlefield to essentially meet the required levels of protection for civilians and those kinds of things. And it's not an end in itself. If it turns out, and I make zero prediction about this, that certain kinds of technologies enable one to achieve simply overwhelmingly better results in terms of safety, even though the individual accountable actors disappear, I'm good with that. And we do it all the time with technologies in domestic life. If self-driving cars turn out to be a better machine technology, we're not going to wind up going back and finding that individual programmer and charging them. I mean, you know, we may have different kinds of mechanisms and insurance and all sorts of things like that, but at some point we wind up saying it's not an end in itself to hold somebody accountable. The end is actually the net increase in safety, and if the machines can do it better, and I have no idea whether they ever would, at some point I think that we're right to sort of, you know, make that move.
Thank you for listening to the Lawfare Podcast, produced in collaboration with the Brookings Institution. Our music was performed by Sophia Yan.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.